and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
A former member of parliament tells Press TV that the government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
From September 23rd to 27th, referendums on joining Russia were held in the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics, as well as the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. Pro-Russian representatives of those regions say joining Russia will secure their territories and restore historical justice. They believe the move is vital in the face of what they call constant acts of terror by the nationalist authorities in Kyiv and NATO countries that supply weapons to Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has backed the referendums, saying Moscow will support the decision made by the residents of the four regions.
Today, in the context of a special military operation and referendums in Donbas, saving people in all territories, namely saving people in all territories where this referendum is being held, is the main focus of Russia.
The referendum will determine the fate of 8 million people living in the LPR, the DPR, and the regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson.
People are tired and exhausted. They are being shelled and bombed every day. As a result, the residents of these republics ask authorities to hold referendums as soon as possible. Most of them have been supporting joining Russia since 2014. The second reason is the fear of any potential revenge by the Ukrainian regime.
Decisions of this kind and steps are always taken when the situation allows it. All the pros and cons are weighed. It has now become clear that the referendums are in line with the plans that the top leadership of Russia has. The future of Russia's constituent regions is complicated. Western countries will impose sanctions against their residents, like in the case of Crimea. Those regions were degraded under the Ukrainian leadership. Money was not invested in them at all. And now Russia is trying to ensure security and normal life in those territories.
Despite shelling of the territories where the secession referendums were held, the voter turnout was over 80% in all those regions. First partial results show that the overwhelming majority of the residents are in favor of joining Russia.
Most of the voters believe that if a state can join NATO despite Russia's opposition, then disputed Ukrainian regions can join Russia without the West's approval. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
As largely predicted by pollsters, the Brothers of Italy party has won the most votes in Italy's snap election, leading a right-wing coalition to victory. The turnout for the general election was about 64%, the lowest percentage ever recorded, around 9 points lower than the 73% turnout for the 2018 general election. Brothers of Italy, a group founded 10 years ago by its leader, Giorgia Meloni, grabbed more than 26% of the vote, while its allies, the League and the more moderate Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia, received respectively 9 and 8%. Meloni said on Monday that a future centre-right government would not betray the trust of the Italian people.
Questo è il tempo della responsabilità.
This is a time for responsibility. This is a time in which, if you want to be part of history, you must realize that we have responsibility towards millions of people who chose us. We won't betray it, like we never have.
Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. Meloni is slated to become the next prime minister, the first woman in Italy who has ever been appointed to that position. The news that a coalition led by Brothers of Italy won a decisive victory in Italy's snap elections has been welcomed by far-right parties from across Europe. The Brothers of Italy has relentlessly advocated for a free Europe, including sovereign countries, and promoted traditional values and essentialist conceptions of gender.
Certainly it won't be an easy task for Meloni to reassure the EU, other international partners and the moderate electorate, and at the same time maintain a strong connection with international populist groups and a more radical electorate. I don't think Meloni will ever find a way to mediate between these issues. That's why I believe her policies won't be too bold.
Among the defeated coalitions in Italy's national elections was the Democratic Party, growingly seen by a large number of Italians as the party of the establishment. Its leader Enrico Letta conceded defeat early on Monday, adding that his party would be the largest opposition force in the next parliament.
It is evident that mistakes were made. I will lead the next party until the next Congress, when a new leader will be determined.
According to the Italian constitution, newly elected members of the parliament must now meet within 20 days. The country's president, Sergio Mattarella, will begin consultations on who should be appointed as the new prime minister with the presidents of the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, the leaders of the main parties, and, at a later stage, with parliamentary groups. Max Civili, Rome.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that, those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this would be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online, calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Saeed Burizap, London.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production and all fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government which relies on debt is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Saleh, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
The government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 50 million Italians have been called to cast their ballot in what could be a pivotal election as Italy and a number of EU countries reel from repercussions of the conflict in Ukraine. The cost of energy has increased by 80% on average across the country compared to a year ago, while at the current rate, inflation is expected to reach 15% in 2023. With a growing number of Italians saying they've lost trust in politics, a high level of abstention from voting, much higher than the record low of 73% in the 2018 general elections, has been predicted.
I don't favor any of the candidates. I see little individual seriousness. As a matter of fact, I didn't want to vote at all. I only came to the polls out of my civic sense.
The electoral law must be changed. Those who deserve to rule are not rewarded. I have great distrust of the electoral system and of Italy's politics.
According to the current electoral law, which has already been reviewed twice by the Constitutional Court, citizens cannot pick their favorite candidates on the ballot. They can only vote for blocked lists. It's the parties themselves who will decide which candidates get the votes.
Last time a government was chosen by voters was 13 years ago when Berlusconi won the elections. All the elected governments that have followed have been overturned and replaced with executives of the establishment.
According to pollsters, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. The Democratic Party comes second with around 22% of preferences. Brothers of Italy party leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, is predicted to become Italy's first ever female prime minister, heading a coalition that features anti-immigration populist Matteo Salvini and 85-year-old media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi. Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. She has been supporting sanctions against Moscow so far, while Salvini and Berlusconi have recently said they should be reconsidered. Political analysts believe it could take weeks before a government is installed in the country. Some even say Italians will likely only see a new executive in November. However, if everything goes as expected, Giorgia Meloni stands as the next prime minister. Max Civili, Rome.
The Israeli military has announced a series of closures on the Palestinian territories that will be imposed during a number of Jewish holidays. The first lockdown is imposed for the new Jewish year called Rosh Hashanah and will last till Tuesday midnight. During the closure, all checkpoints between the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Israel will remain closed. This means Palestinians who have Israeli-issued permits are not allowed to enter Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948. The Israeli army routinely seals off the West Bank on Jewish holidays, but the closure for the Palestinians is yet another form of the collective punishment that Palestinians have to bitterly endure because of the Israeli occupation.
Closure of the Palestinian territories, including the West Bank cities and refugee camps, comes as part of the collective punishment imposed by the Israeli regime under the pretext of celebrating the new Jewish year. It also imposes more rules on the Palestinians. This measure is part of a widespread war that's meant to strengthen the occupation.
This year, the closure comes at a sensitive time due to rising armed confrontations between Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank. Early on Sunday, another Palestinian was killed during Israeli military raid on Nablus. The Israeli military claimed its troops identified a group of armed Palestinians driving near Nablus. Regime troops opened fire at them, killing Saad al-Kuni and took his body. Three more Palestinians were wounded during the operation.
The Israeli troops claim the operation came under the routine raids, but what's happening is a barbaric act. They are murdering more Palestinians in cold blood. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone. It's clear there is a green light from the Israeli regime and its army to kill more youth under the pretext of confronting resistance fighters.
Meanwhile, scores of Jewish settlers escorted by police broke into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds and performed rituals in its compound. The Israeli military has already increased its military presence across the occupied Palestinian territories even before the start of Jewish holidays. This comes amid the regime's atrocities and military operations to prevent Palestinians' resistance. Mona Khandil, occupied Ramallah.
Rome's suburban Tiburtino Terzo quarter is once again home to a new edition of the Palestine Festival, a four-day initiative organized by the Palestinian Association of Rome and Lazio Region and the Palestinian Youth Association, created by Palestinian expat Youssef Salman with the aim to foster intercultural understanding and promoting Palestinian culture in the Italian capital. This year's edition of the festival also has a focus on Palestine and Latin America.
Many Latin American countries have been supporting the Palestinian cause. That's what I told to the people who attended the meeting this evening. I also told them about our President Abbas being in New York to discuss a two-state solution. But when will Israel sit at the negotiation table?
A number of Latin American heads of state came out and spoke loudly, proclaiming the rights of the Palestinians and denouncing the Israeli persecution against them at the UN over the past days. At Rome's Palestine Festival, diplomats from the Bolivian, Cuban, and Venezuelan embassies reiterated their support for the cause of Palestinian people in order to restore their legitimate rights. A commemoration of Shirin Abu Akleh was held during a panel on the dreadful living conditions of Palestinian journalists in the occupied territories. Recently, a new forensic analysis proved that the Israeli sniper who killed her could see that Shirin was a journalist before firing the bullet.
In the West Bank, journalists are shot, wounded, or arrested. In the Gaza Strip, there is no internet, no power. We cannot work. Israel simply doesn't want us to do our job. 55 Palestinian journalists have been killed by the Israeli forces in about 20 years. In regards to Shirin, Israeli soldiers knew full well she was a journalist when they killed her. It was a warning sent to all of us journalists in Palestine.
The Palestine Festival will continue on Saturday with an initiative commemorating the Sabra and Shatila massacre and a conference on Italy's and the EU's political stance on the plight of the Palestinians. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight. Russia is the world's third largest oil producer and a leading exporter of natural gas, fertilizer and wheat. And also Ukraine's grain feeds millions of people around the world. But with the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine on 24th of February and the consequent heavy Western sanctions against Moscow, food and energy trade was disrupted. And the inflation caused by Russia-Ukraine conflict has spread all over the world. We have taken a look at some of the world press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian writes, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, the world's leading economies are sliding into recession as the global energy and inflation crisis sparked by Russia's special operation in Ukraine cut growth by more than previously forecast. A dependency on expensive gas for heavy industry and home heating will plunge Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom into a long period of recession after global growth was projected by the OECD to slow to 2.2% in 2023 from a forecast in June of 2.8%. With the global economy needing to grow by about 4% to keep pace with rising populations, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said incomes per head will be lower in many countries. OECD's interim chief economist, Alvaro Pereira, said the world was paying a steep price for the Ukraine conflict, NATO's expansionist policies, and consequently Russia's decision to restrict access to gas supplies more tightly than was forecast in June. He said governments would need to encourage households and businesses to reduce their consumption of gas and oil to help weather a difficult winter. Alvaro Pereira, OECD's chief economist, also supported the determination of central banks to reduce inflation by raising interest rates. He said, "We need to reduce demand, there's no doubt about that, and monetary and fiscal authorities need to work hand in hand to achieve it." China's economic growth rate is expected to drop this year to 3.2%, its lowest since the 1970s, causing a large decrease in trade with neighbours South Korea, Vietnam and Japan, dragging down their capacity to grow. However, the Paris-based Policy Forum was most alarmed by the outlook across Europe, which is most directly exposed to the fallout from Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The OECD forecast that Britain's GDP growth would be flat in 2023. However, this projection does not take into account the measures announced in Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng's mini-budget on Friday, 23rd of September. The OECD forecast a drop in economic growth in the Eurozone from 3.1% this year to only 0.3% in 2023, meaning that many countries in the 19-member currency bloc will spend at least part of the year in recession. A recession is defined as two straight quarters of contraction. France could escape a recession if it grows by 0.8% next year, as predicted by the OECD, but will suffer along with other European countries after a downgrade in gross domestic product growth since June of 1.3 percentage points. Germany's dependence on Russian gas before the Ukraine conflict means the German economy will shrink by 0.7% next year, down from a June estimate of 1.7% growth. The Fortune website explains more about the same story. One of the top policy and economic development forums reports during the first half of 2022, inflation in many countries skyrocketed to levels unseen since the 1980s. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said on Monday, 26th of September, in its latest Economic Outlook report, that fixing the problem might require engineering a dramatic economic slowdown in many countries. The two drivers behind the expected slowdown are the costs associated with the Ukraine war, which the OECD said will lead to a $2.8 trillion drop in global gross domestic product next year, and central banks worldwide tightening their monetary policies in an effort to reduce inflation, measures that could tip several major economies into prolonged recession. The OECD Secretary-General Matthias Cormann said in a statement, the global economy has lost momentum in the wake of Russia's conflict with Ukraine. Gross domestic product growth has stalled in many economies and economic indicators point to an extended slowdown. While the economic outlook has darkened around the world, not every country will be affected in the same way. In the United States, where the U.S. Federal Reserve has implemented a series of aggressive interest rate hikes to slow inflation, economic growth will slip from 1.5% this year to 0.5% next year. Also, Europe is set to bear the brunt of next year's economic decline, as the region with the most exposure to the Ukraine war and its aftershocks. Europe's economic downturn will likely combine with more persistent inflation, especially energy. The OECD report says the situation in Europe could push many countries into a full-year recession in 2023, while growth will remain slow until 2024. Recessions in European countries will likely lead to a decline in employment and in hours worked, with some European manufacturers already furloughing staff and cutting operational hours due to high electricity costs. OECD Secretary-General Matthias Cormann said inflationary pressures that were already present as the global economy emerged from the coronavirus pandemic have been severely aggravated by the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. This has further driven rising energy and food prices that now threaten living standards for people across the globe. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency elaborates more on the same issue. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, reported insufficient supply diversification and demand reductions could cause shortages that will push up energy prices, dent confidence and financial conditions, and make it necessary for businesses to temporarily ration their use of gas. The OECD said, taken together, these shocks could reduce economic growth in the European economies by over 1.25 percentage points in 2023 relative to baseline and raise inflation by over 1.5 percentage points. This would push many European countries into recession in 2023. While the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, noted that higher interest rates are a primary driver behind global recession risks, it said such action was needed to tame inflation. The report said continued monetary policy tightening is needed to lower inflation durably, adding that policymakers must carefully balance economic uncertainty with the need to bring prices down. However, World Bank officials have called on central banks to refrain from competitive interest rate hikes that will push the global economy into recession and harm the economies of developing countries the most.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Tensions are ratcheting up between Turkey and Greece once again over two Aegean islands near the Turkish coast. But a quick history check shows that Greece and Turkey, which are both part of NATO, have feuded for years over maritime borders and energy exploration rights in the Aegean and East Mediterranean seas. In this edition of the program, we will look at whether this crisis between the two can escalate into a possible military confrontation or not, and how this will affect the Eastern Mediterranean region as a whole. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joins us from London. Also joining us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University, İlter Turan, joins us from Istanbul.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So let me first start with you, Marcus Papadopoulos, and taking a look at this crisis at the present time that has the two heating up again against each other. Greece deploying U.S. armored vehicles on these two islands, and the ships are loaded with what is said to be U.S. armored vehicles. First question that comes up is, why is Greece deploying these vehicles onto the two islands?
Well, let it be said that the terrible level of tension which exists between Turkey and Greece, coupled with the pure hatred in existence between the two countries, is a profound demonstration of NATO disunity. It is also a profound demonstration of why, when NATO leaders claim that the Western military bloc is unified, they are lying, because NATO is full of divisions. There is great tension between Turkey and Bulgaria, there is tension between Hungary and Romania, and there is tension between Bulgaria and North Macedonia. But turn into the crisis in the Aegean Sea. Erdogan, like his predecessors, is threatening the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Greece. Greece is a member of the United Nations, and its borders are internationally recognized. Secondly, Erdogan, again like his predecessors, is pursuing a greater Turkey, like how a greater Albania is being pursued in the Balkans. And thirdly, Erdogan, in threatening the status quo in the Aegean Sea, is effectively undermining the Treaty of Lausanne of 1923, because the Treaty of Lausanne underpins the status quo in the Aegean Sea.
Sure. Do you agree with our guest there, İlter Turan?
I don't know where to start from, but let me say that this unity of NATO, which the gentleman has referred to, is of course true, but then NATO was established for a specific purpose which did not preclude disagreement among its members. In fact, we had some actual fighting as NATO was an anti-Soviet bloc treaty. We had fighting among allies, namely, this is always the case. In fact, as the reason why NATO was formed declines in importance, there is a greater tendency among its members to fall into disagreements. Now, I was fascinated by the gentleman's giving examples of how there are differences between allies, and he referred to a disagreement between Bulgaria and Turkey. I'm not aware of it, but I'm aware of a number of bad relations Greece has with its neighbors, but I will not go into that. I think the question of having weapons on these islands puts the argument that national sovereignty is about international law. And about
well, let me jump in and quickly, if you don't mind. I just want to ask you, before you continue, I want to ask you, is what has happened legal or not?
It is illegal. There's no question about that. I mean, you know, according to the treaties of both Lausanne and Paris, Greece is not permitted to arm these islands. Now, the reason Greece is presumably arming these islands is because it is its sovereign right. If we buy that argument, then international agreements have no meaning. And also, let me make one final observation. The gentleman suggested that a number of countries in the region were expansionist. There is really one truly expansionist country in the region, and that is Greece itself. Just look at the map of Greece after wars and what has happened, and it has constantly kept expanding. You look at Turkey after it was founded as a republic, and there is no expansion with the exception of a couple of international agreements. So if there is an expansionary power to be identified in the region, everybody knows who that is.
Marcus Papadopoulos, so is Greece expansionary or Turkey?
What you have just heard from the guest in Istanbul is an inversion of the truth. It is absolutely preposterous to claim that Greece is an expansionist country. Let us look at the facts. Turkey illegally occupies a part of the Republic of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies a part of Syria. Turkey, at its will, supported by both America and Britain, invades northern Iraq when it chooses to. Furthermore, it is not Greece which is calling into question Turkey's territorial integrity in accordance with the Treaty of Lausanne. It is Turkey which is doing so. So, quite frankly, the guest in Istanbul does not have a legal or political leg to stand on. And we have to address the reasons as to why Greece is why Greece has deployed military hardware to the islands in question, because Erdogan is making territorial claims against them. The Treaty of Lausanne stipulates that Greece must not establish naval bases on those islands, and Athens has not done so.
Very well. But so that's a point that we need our guests to address, because that is what the agreement specified, isn't it? That you basically are banned from building naval bases or fortifications on these islands, in this particular case, Lesbos and Samos. Isn't that true, Ilter Turan?
Apparently, the gentleman is very selective about the reading of the treaty. Actually, Greece is allowed to have law enforcement forces on the island, but nothing else, no military figures. So, but then let me turn back to some of the allegations the gentleman is felt fully free to volunteer. Of course, it may have escaped the gentleman's attention that the Turkish presence in Syria and in Iraq is not one of claiming that this is Turkish territory. It's not incorporating that, but it is according to the Adana Accords that Turkish forces are in Syria, and it is again according to agreements with the Iraqi government in 1998 that the Turkish forces are in northern Iraq. And the moment the particular reason why they're there is gone, Turkey has no claims on the territory of these countries. So I think this is imaginary. Cyprus, I guess the gentleman has forgotten that the conditions under which Turkey intervened on Cyprus. First of all, it's not Greece, incidentally. Let's make that clear. It's not Greece, but it was a military takeover engineered by the Greek government that was that essentially warranted mm-hmm. Turkish intervention on the island. And Turks were being literally ethnically cleansed, so that this intervention was okay. to stop ethnic cleansing.
I think our guest wants to say something in reaction to your statements. Go ahead, Marcus.
Indeed. Turkey is a guarantor, or was a guarantor, of the Republic of Cyprus prior to its invasion of the island in July of 1974. So there were two stages in the Turkish invasion. Attila I effectively put a stop to the coup in Nicosia. That effectively also brought down the military regime in Athens. So therefore, Attila I restored the status quo to the Republic of Cyprus. So why did Turkey then, in August of 1974, launch Attila II when the status quo had already been restored by Attila I? I put that to the gentleman in Istanbul.
Okay, a quick response, because we've got to move beyond this. Because there are other areas of friction and crises between the two that involve a lot of other countries at the same time. Go ahead. A
gentleman has forgotten the fact that Turks were being killed right and left on the island. So that's all I've got to say.
Can you explain Attila II?
All right, let's move on. This is what's interesting here. And Iltar, let me address this to you. Iltar Turan, if I may. You're having Turkey react to what has occurred because you have hardware that was donated by Washington, which is said to be, let me read here, 23 and 18 vehicles respectively, donated to Athens. Now, I'm looking at 41 vehicles. I don't think anybody in the right mind would just donate 41 vehicles. What is the purpose behind the U.S. donating these vehicles to Greece?
Well, you have to ask that question to the Americans. Apparently, I mean, they're... ostensible reason is that they are setting up a defense line against Russian expansion, which they find is threatening. And because it is difficult to access the Black Sea through Turkey, because the Montreux Convention does not give foreign warships the liberty of moving in and out of the Black Sea, this sort of Greece, Bulgaria, Romania connection is presumably a way into the Black Sea. But it also appears that the United States is setting up a second line of defense because it doesn't think it can rely on Turkey for NATO purposes sufficiently. And Greece has been made into a depot of U.S. armaments. They're increasing on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And I think because of this changed American position, Greeks have come under the illusion that somehow the United States is ready to defend them. Obviously, great states don't let small states to lead them into conflicts. And it is always important to remember that.
All right, so let's move on here to oil and gas explorations. Marcus, we only have another 12 minutes, even less, but this whole thing is so wide, and the number of countries that are involved are so many when you really dig into this. What are we looking at? We know both Turkey and Greece, they're in a race to develop these energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean, but they're on separate sides. Where are we going with that, if you can tell us, and what's legal and illegal when it comes to oil explorations in terms of who has the right and who doesn't?
Well, America doesn't favor Greece over Turkey. Indeed, historically, America has favored Turkey over Greece. Why? Because Turkey is of immense geostrategic importance to Washington. And the reason as to why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with these vehicles, which Athens has now deployed to the islands in the Aegean Sea, is because of Erdogan. Firstly, America has
but a problematic relationship. Aren't they both NATO members? I mean, if they're NATO members, they shouldn't work off each other. I guess that goes back to your division statement, right?
Yes, absolutely. NATO is not unified. NATO is a very divided military bloc. But this is all aimed at Erdogan. Firstly, America has a problematic relationship with Erdogan, not with the Turkish state, not with the Turkish establishment, but with Erdogan. So the Americans are sending a message to Erdogan by giving the Greek army.
Okay, I got to get a reaction from our guest in Istanbul.
Well, it's about
Russia. Do you agree, Ilter Tunar? Do you agree with our guest there?
I'm curious about this explanation reduced down to a person who happens to be the president of Turkey at this time. I'm not an admirer of him, mind you, but I have seen no indication that his government has any plans to invade any Greek island. And there is no feeling in Turkey that they want to invade a neighboring our country's territory. This is entirely false. And, you know,
it's
interestingly
not a question
enough,
which was put to you.
Let me just say that for the most part, many Turks feel Erdogan was more an American creation. So as to why they are trying to stop him now, if that is the case, would be a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we got to dig into this oil and gas exploration because that has been brought up to a point where there have been other countries involved, because I'm going to skip as to the legality or the illegality, but, you know, this involves a number of countries. We're looking at Cyprus. We're looking at France to have gotten involved. We're looking at the possible military aspect to this. Back in 2020 is when there was really a point where you had Rafale jets from France, Marcus, that were flown into that area where there were really heated exchanges. What are we looking at when it comes to that? Because it's not getting resolved, obviously.
The Americans have gathered their allies in the region in what I describe as an Eastern Mediterranean gathering involving Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and of course Britain and France, together naturally with America, because there are vast reserves of oil and gas there. And of course, the Americans ultimately want to secure that for themselves. And they will do that by their Eastern Mediterranean gathering. That is another reason as to why I have long contended that American supremacy in West Asia is not on the way out. It is not eroding. If anything, it has been boosted by gathering Washington's friends and allies in the region. But Turkey has not been included. Why? Not because of Turkey per se, but because Erdogan is not playing ball, so to speak, especially when it concerns Russia. Erdogan is intensifying Turkey's economic relationship with America, with Russia, and that is to great annoyance and to great fury of policymakers in Washington. Mm-hmm. So again, that is why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with this weaponry. It's a message to Erdogan, not to Turkey, to Erdogan.
Ilter Tunar, a Turkey publication and media organization that's very well known, has ran this headline where experts believe Greece's increasing violations of Turkish airspace is part of an agenda that's been encouraged by the West to corner Turkey for taking an independent foreign policy. That in particular obviously falls squarely on Erdogan and his stance. Do you agree with that or not?
But actually, I don't agree with that, because when we look at the history of the relations, such allegations have been there all along. The gentleman in London introduced the Russian equation to the discussion. And, you know, Turkish-Russian relations got on the road to improvement ever since the end of the Soviet Union. It's nothing new. So I think this is one thing. Secondly, the argument that this area is blessed with immense amount of natural resources is still something that waits to be proven. In fact, the gentleman's attention may have been away when the United States decided that the idea of building a pipeline, for example, was simply uneconomical. And that is why there are current discussions between Israel and Turkey with regard to whether it would not be possible to connect the Israeli gas to the Turkish pipeline system. So, you know, the critical thing is that this sort of economic zone discussions are political. They need to be political. All the riparian countries need to be incorporated into a discussion. It's not that you could organize some against the others. You have to get them all if you want stability and peace and prosperous exploitation of resources.
Okay. Well, we need to expand more on why you have chosen Erdogan and separated him, Marcus Papadopoulos, from the Turkey equation, because that's very interesting, because you have the way that either coming from Turkey or otherwise, that Erdogan is purely trying to be separated from Turkey, and he's the one that they want to corner. Are they going to be successful in doing that? Because you can't separate, you know, him from Turkey at this point anyways.
The Americans are masters in understanding and having the capabilities to manage difficult relationships. There have been times in the past when American allies and friends have leaders who have been problematic to Washington. But Washington knows that Turkey will always be a staunch friend and ally to America. Turkey will always be in existence, but Erdogan will not always be in existence. That is why the Americans know that their strategic partnership with Turkey is as firm as it has ever been before. There is no tension between the American and Turkish establishments, but for the Americans, they are having problems with Erdogan. Like how okay. There is no tension between the Israeli and Turkish establishments. There is tension between the Israeli establishment and Erdogan.
Thank you very much for that, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. And Ilter Turan from Istanbul, thank you. Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This